So you want to pass it on?
Yes, I do.
That's good.
So, good evening, everyone. My name is Prabhu Asamyan. I'm the Richard Ovanesian Chair of Modern Armenian History here at UCLA. And I teach also global history as well. And I run this chair, which has a series of lectures on a yearly basis, which focus on Armenian interactions with the outside world, on Armenians and cross-cultural history. And nothing could perhaps be better as a way of introducing our next speaker than to say that his research focuses on the par excellence community that interacted with others and integrated very successfully. And that is, of course, the community to which I belong, that is the Ethiopian Armenian community. And that I can say, at the risk of expressing some bias, that should stand out among the most refined Armenian communities in the diaspora. Fairly integrated into Ethiopian culture and at the same time still Armenian, and very productive in terms of local as well as global impact. So it's a very distinct honor and pleasure to welcome you here today and to welcome our speaker featured for this event, Boris Acemyan. And let me say a few words about Boris before I officially introduce him with a few words of biographical detail. First time I met Boris must have been 5-6 years ago, but I first heard of Boris as early as 2001 or maybe 1999. You can correct me if my memory is rusty, but I remember seeing an essay on the Ethiopian Armenian community in the pages of Revue des Etudes Arméniennes. And I remember thinking to myself, who is this Russian, Boris Acemyan, who dares to write about the Ethiopian Armenian community? And then years later, I met him through a mutual friend, Raymond Kevorkian, an exemplary scholar in Paris. And I met him when I visited the Noumarian collection, which is where Boris spends most of his time. We're very grateful to have Boris as the director of the Noumarian Library in Paris. For those of you who are not aware of it, it's one of the premier collections, archival collections in the world. They have one of the richest collections of Armenian newspapers and so on. Has a very interesting history. Boris gave a talk about this, the Noumarian and the AGBU's role in creating the Noumarian a few days ago at Ararat Eskijan, and on which note I'd like to express thanks personal thanks to Maggie Goshen, who was here with us, who is responsible for inviting Boris to our shores. So Boris Acemyan, for those of you who don't know him, is a historian and a director of the AGB and Mubar Library, of which I spoke just a few seconds ago. He is the co-editor-in-chief of the bilingual academic journal Etudes Arméniennes Contemporaines, and he defended his PhD in 2011 at the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales in Paris and the Università degli Studi in Napoli. His book, La fanfare du Negus, Les Arméniens en Éthiopie, 19e et 20e siècle, was published by the Edition of the École des Hautes Études in 2013, and is unfortunately for those of us who are monolingual or only read in English, it is not available in English. It was written in French, but we have hopes that in the not too distant future, the work will be translated into English and published by a reputable university press right here in the U.S. So Boris, in addition to all his activities at Noumarian, is also the co-editor of a volume with Alexandra Garbarini called Victims, Testimonies and Understanding Mass Violence in 2015. He's also a co-editor with Sosi Andrejian and Talin Sujian of a collection of essays called Jerusalem in the Making, Spaces and Communities, which appeared this year. And he's a member of the editorial board of a couple of very important French journals, one of which is 20e siècle, Revue d'Histoire, And it is my distinct pleasure to invite and to introduce to you our next speaker, my friend Boris Ajemyan. Thank you for coming, Boris.
Thank you. Thank you very much. thank you, Cebu, for this very nice introduction. And first of all, so thank you to the Richard Hovhannisyan Chair in Modern Armenian History for this invitation. Also to my friend and colleague Cebu for organizing and chairing this lecture. So it is a honor and a great pleasure for me to be here for the first time. I wish also to thank the UCLA African Studies Center and the UCLA Center for Near Eastern Studies. So I've spoken about some of you are aware of the fact that I've spoken about more or less the same topic yesterday in another place, not far from here, not so far, even if Los Angeles is quite a huge city. And so I'm trying to make it slightly different today. When I started my research on the Armenians in Ethiopia a bit more than 20 years ago, I never thought this would be a history of the Armenian community. My aim was rather to write a part of Ethiopian history, truly of Ethiopian history. Let's say a part of the history of foreigners in Ethiopia. But from the beginning of this research, from the very beginning of my research, a paradox appeared. Since the Armenian experience in Ethiopia didn't seem to be the experience of a foreigner community. This paradox was epitomized in a sentence that I heard from an Ethiopian friend during my first stay in Addis, saying roughly, Ethiopia is a nation made of 90 ethnic groups, and Armenians are our 91st ethnic group. In the meantime, I was told by researchers that Armenians were not to be considered as Ferenc in Ethiopia. I think that is to say Frank. Ferenc comes directly from the word Frank, which can have several meanings in Amharinia today, but the meaning is European. It can also mean white man or at large foreigners. Everything which is foreign, coming from abroad, can be designated as Ferenc. Even a habit, a use, a custom which is not considered as native can be considered as Ferenc. And the fact is that the Armenians in Ethiopia were not considered as Ferenc. They were not called Ferenc, although all the white people were called Ferenc. And if you walk in the street in Addis Ababa, one of the first words you hear is "you Ferenc." "You Ferenc" is the two words claimed by children in the streets, and they add money generally just behind, just after Ferenc, because of course we are expected to give money, this appellation was not at the time when there was really an Armenian community which was more visible. There is still an Armenian community, but it is less visible now. At the time, the word was not used for them, which is quite interesting. So the meetings I had with Armenians in Ethiopia from the very beginning confirmed this assertion that, in a way, Armenians were part of the Ethiopian people, part of the Ethiopian society. Because the people I met fully considered themselves as Ethiopians. They were all speaking and writing Amharic, Amharania, the, let's say, official language of Ethiopia. Their families had settled in the country for two or three generations, and apparently they felt like having a special attachment to Ethiopia. In a way, they were giving body to another assertion, an assertion which was given to me by Mr. Avedis Terzian. I will talk quite a lot about him today. Mr. Avedis Terzian, who died in 2000 in Addis Abeba, was saying that among all the foreigners in Ethiopia, Armenians were the closest to the Ethiopian people. In a way, as if they were somewhere between Ferenc, so Frank, white men, foreigners, between Ferenc and Habesha, that is to say Abyssinian, the Abyssinian people, the Christian peoples of the Ethiopian and Eritrean highlands, speaking Semitic language like Amharinia and Tigrinya, and using the syllabic alphabet. So the Armenians were between these two worlds, somewhere between these two realities, Ferenc and Habesha, and still after 20 years of study, I don't know exactly where they were, but they were somewhere between them. So through my research, I tried to find out and to explain how such a particular situation became possible. Historically, how was it constructed? How was it made, this intermediate situation of the Armenian people, or let's say people, descendants of Armenian immigration in Ethiopia? In my PhD, I was writing, like a kind of reflex, Armenian people. I was rather choosing descendants of Armenian immigrants to Ethiopia, because it was very difficult to define people as if they were only Armenian or only Ethiopian or only something else. Generally speaking, here we are touching to global problem, even if the topic I'm dealing with, as you may know, is a very specific topic, because the Armenians in Ethiopia were never numerous. And I will give you a few estimations soon. But today, you have to know that Armenians in Ethiopia are about 80 people. 80. 80. So it is a very specific case. Very specific case studies. And of course, Mr. Ajimian has no right to invent big theory about this, to build theories about this very specific case. But in the meantime, although it is a case, let's say, of micro history, in the meantime, it has connection with more global questions, more global issues. For example, the diaspora issues. Generally speaking, diasporas are considered as social construction that epitomize or even personifies the notion of exile. This perception is very well rooted in the academic literature on diasporas, especially Jewish and Armenian diasporas. For example, the notion of homeland in the literature on the diaspora, in the academic literature on the diaspora, the notion of homeland, for example, as utilized by William Safran, is generally understood as equivalent or synonymous to the country of the ancestors of the people. However, diasporas also have what Hatzik Tololian calls a sedentary logic. And this idea of a sedentary logic, to me, it is very important. And there is no doubt that Armenians felt at home in Ethiopia. Actually, one could say that they created another homeland in their country of residence. And that is the conclusion to which I arrived. And that I tried to deconstruct the making of this homeland and try to explain how historically such a reality was possible to emerge. So my aim has never been to write the history of an Armenian community for itself. It is also the reason why in the book that I wrote, that I've written, many people will not find the name of their ancestors, and sometimes they feel, they blame me for this, because of course there are not so many books on the question. But my work is not the history of the Armenians in Ethiopia. It is something different. It is rather to explain the making of a historical process into the context of the host society. But how? And is it possible to write the history of such a sophisticated process within a community which almost disappeared and left very few traces of its own past in the present? When I started my research, the number of Armenians still living in Addis Ababa, there were no Armenians living anymore in Ethiopia, in other towns. The last one had left Diredawa. The last one who was living in Diredawa, the second town of the country, had left the town to emigrate to Canada, I think, just 1 year before my first journey to Ethiopia. And so at the time, many Armenians had left the country in the 1980s, when Ethiopia was under a Marxist regime, the regime of the Turk, and the Armenian community had become very small and only visible in Addis Ababa. Moreover, the community had never been big. I will give you a few estimations now. Alors, this map shows first the origin of the people who emigrated to Ethiopia in the time of Menelik. That is to say, the end of the 19th century, roughly from 1889, date of his coronation as an emperor, to 1913, date, official date of his death. At the time, most of the people who were coming from the Ottoman Empire to emigrate to Ethiopia were coming from Arab Kir. They were mainly Arab Getsi. And also from Atlas, from the Vilayet of Harpet at large, from Agen, from Palu also. Later on, there was a shift towards the south, and more people came from the Vilayet of Aleppo, and mainly from the city of Ain Tab. But in the first period, the period before the genocide, the first immigration of Armenians to Ethiopia, I estimate that there were about 150 to 200 Armenians in the country at the end of the reign of Menelik. It means in 1913, just before World War I. You heard well, no more than 200 people, including men, women, and children, because I have to stress that the Armenian community was one of the first foreign community to include women and children in Ethiopia. At the time, there were very few foreigners in Ethiopia, so although the Armenians were only 200, they were one of the four main groups of foreigners in Ethiopia, with the Greeks, the Indians, and the Arabs, the so-called Arabs, who were coming mostly from Yemen. And later on, after the genocide, this number increased. Five times more. The Armenian community reached the number of 1,200 people in the end of the 1920s, beginning of the 1930s, before the Italian occupation of Ethiopia. 1,200 people. So very few again, and still at this time they were one of the most important foreign communities in Ethiopia, because the number of foreigners in Ethiopia was very low. So the community has never been big, and so of course the tracks, the clues, the sources are very rare. Very rare. Generally speaking, the Ethiopian historiography describes Armenians. I'm not speaking about the history written by Ethiopians specifically, but Ethiopian historiography. The historiography of Ethiopia, which a lot of foreign historians contributed to this, including European and North American historians. For example, Richard Pankhurst, very well known in Ethiopia. Generally speaking, the Ethiopian historiography described Armenians, like Greeks and Indians, merely as foreign traders and craftsmen who contributed to introduce technologies, new products, and practices in Ethiopia. So they were seen essentially as brokers or middlemen between the foreign world, the European civilization, let's say, and the local society, as a kind of a kink in the chain between Europeans and Ethiopians. We can establish a parallel between this conception and the concept of trading diaspora and middlemen minorities, concepts which were developed in the 1960s and 1970s and are still used today in the academic literature. If we consider the definition given by Edna Bonasic, the middleman minority is a population delimited on an ethnic basis with a fixed and collective identity of a go-between in the local society where it is established. In this society, the middlemen occupy professions that are neglected or seen with disdain by the local population and that are characterized by their fluidity, mainly in the commercial field, involving small amounts of investments, not like agriculture or industry, so that the middlemen are permanently in a favorable position to leave the country in case of a sudden necessity. For example, if there is a crisis, and if the local population turns xenophobe against them, so they are able to leave the country very quickly. This is the pattern of the middleman minority. This situation would maintain, according to Edna Bonasich, would maintain the middleman minorities indefinitely in the state of foreigners and would often raise the hostility of the local population against them. But the situation of Armenians in 20th century Ethiopia was far more complex than the one of the go-between because of the depth of their settlement in the host society that I briefly described earlier. For the Armenians who lived and still live in Ethiopia, the host society was not only a host society, it became a homeland in the course of the 20th century, a real homeland, a genuine homeland. This is quite obvious if you consider the memory of Armenian immigration to Ethiopia. Indeed, memory of immigration to Ethiopia that has never been taken into consideration in the Ethiopian historiography. There is a lot of work to do, and not only about the Armenian community, but also about the Greek community, the Italian community, the Indian community. Still, the work has to be done. Because, as I was saying yesterday in another place, a lot of things that you can learn about the real life, the real experience of the Armenian or the descendants of Armenian immigrants to Ethiopia in the 20th century, you could not find them in archives, you could not find them in printed books, and you have to consider other kind of sources, and you also have to create your own archive in a way by going on the field and to try to make these new sources emerge. So if I may authorize myself to speak about the collective memory of Armenian immigration to Ethiopia, I would say that Ethiopia appeared in the memory of Armenian immigration to Ethiopia as a homeland of substitution for Armenian immigrants and for their descendants. So, So the question of the source, and I will not be long on this question after I will enter more deeply in the subject. The question of the sources, of course, is a major problem for historians, and historians faces for this topic the problem that there are no specific collection of archives available because Armenians in Ethiopia didn't produce such archives, and also because others, it means Europeans, it means also Ethiopians, we are not that much interested in writing facts and data about Armenians in this country. So Armenians remain quite invisible in the written sources, in the sources that are the most used by the historians. That's why they are not part of the global narrative of Ethiopian history, of the traditional narrative. And that's why it was absolutely necessary for me to explore other kind of materials, including oral sources, including photographs that were kept not in archival centers but in the families, including even funeral inscriptions in the Armenian cemetery, a fundamental source, for example, in order to counterbalance and moreover to complete the skeleton given by classical, written and printed European or even Ethiopian sources. I tried to raise this problem when I chose to focus on a very peculiar event, a very small event, the founding of the Fanfare Royale, the brass band of the king, which was created by Ras Teferi, the future emperor of Haile Selassie, also known under the Amharinia designation of its Armenian musicians, Arbalojoj, which means the 40 children or the 40 kids. So, this fanfare is... There are many reasons to be interested by this fanfare, because I said that sources were lacking. I said that the community slowly disappeared. Still, didn't disappear, but I mean, it is very weak now and very invisible. But a lot of things have been forgotten by people about Armenians. They are no more in the landscape. They are no more visible, but in the meantime, there are some anecdotes, some things that are still remembered. And one of these things, which is the most remembered, is the story of the Arbali judge. Even if it is not sometimes a true story, but it is remembered with the name of the Arbali judge. So this fanfare, this brass band, was created by Ras Teferi. He was the Ethiopian crown prince. In 1924, when Ethiopia has been accepted by the League of the Nations to be a member of the League of the Nations, it was the only African country who was a member of the League of the Nations at the time when almost all Africa was colonized. He went to travel, an exceptional travel, his first travel abroad, by the way, a travel in Europe. And his first stop was in Jerusalem, where he visited several religious communities, including the Armenian community, the Armenian monastery. And in the Armenian monastery at the time, there was the Araradian orphanage, which had been founded after the genocide in order to welcome, to host young Armenian orphans. And in this Araradian orphanage, there was a brass band which played when the king came into the monastery. So he offered to the Armenian patriarch to bring these kids in Ethiopia, where they could become his personal fanfare, his personal brass band, and the Ethiopian government's brass band, because at the time Ethiopia had no official music. So there was an agreement which was passed, and these 40 boys, mainly coming from the area of the Vaspuragan, they went to Ethiopia, where they stayed from 1924 to 1925, and when they played the official music of the Ethiopian monarchy. And their master of music, Mr. Kevork Nalbandian, their director, was asked by Teferi to write an Ethiopian anthem, because at the time Ethiopia had no specific anthem. So he wrote the first national anthem of Ethiopia, and this anthem was played by these 40 kids during 5 years for the first time. And after this anthem remained the anthem, the official anthem of Ethiopia for 50 years until the Ethiopian Revolution. And there are also things to say about the new anthem, which was written after the Ethiopian Revolution, because there was another Armenian musician, actually the nephew of Kevork Nalbandian, Nerses Nalbandian, who is considered as one of the most important Ethiopian musicians of the second half of the century. He himself participated in a competition for the writing of the new anthem, and he won. His partition was selected as the best one, but finally the new dictator at the time, Mengistu Haile Mariam, would have said, not again an Albanian and not a second time an Armenian. So his copy, his partition was left aside. So this fanfare is also known. There are not so many sources. Here there is a photo, only a photo, nothing written about it, in the autobiography of Haile Selassie himself. And you can see the fanfare, the young boys, their master of music, Kevork Nalbandian, and a few Ethio-Armenians, like Mr. Krikorios Borossian, who was a merchant in the palace of Menelik, the predecessor of Haile Selassie, and his son, who was the son of Krikorios Borossian and a lady of the Ethiopian aristocracy, and he worked at the palace with his father and some of his brothers too. So this event, or today, is mainly remembered as an event of the history of music in Ethiopia. But there are other reasons to be interested by this event. It is quite meaningful that today it is one of the only events of this history that is still remembered, that left track into the collective memory. And in the meantime, it has never interested historians. So we should try to explain the fact. One of the questions I asked during my research was why Crown Prince Rastafari decided to create this fanfare, and why he decided to choose Armenian unexperienced orphans to play the official music of Ethiopia. And also because also this we know by the autobiographic notes written by Kevork Nalbandian that most of these young children, they were unable to play. They were simply unable to play when they arrived to Ethiopia. So they were not even trained in the art of music. So why not have chosen professional musicians? They were not lacking at the time. In this period, there was no modern music in Ethiopia, no modern instruments, no European style music, no Western style music, and these children had an input in the development of such music. For example, Garabet Akalmazian, he was a former member of the Armenian brass band, and when the Armenian brass band was disbanded, he became the trainer of an Ethiopian brass band, and this Ethiopian brass band was formed on the same pattern as the former Armenian brass band, and even he was teaching them Armenian songs and the like. For example, Tashnak Tsagan tunes that were played in front of a Turkish delegate in 1930 during the coronation of Haile Selassie. So, very few historians, no historians was interested by this fanfare. Indeed, there is almost nothing written about it, and when there is something written about it, it is very strange, because it is only the few testimonies written by Europeans say that this fanfare was no full brass band. They were playing out of tune, it was a cacophony, their director was too fat, he was ridiculous. The repertoire was unadapted, because they were supposed to play official music, to play the national anthems, but sometimes they were playing popular songs like Ne pleure pas Jeannette, ou Auprès de ma blonde, or new songs which were sung in France, which were à la mode, but which were really unadapted to the situation. And for example, there is a good example that I said yesterday, when the Archbishop, the Coptic Archbishop Johannes, visited Ethiopia in 1929, he was welcomed by Rastafari at the railway station, the new railway station. Ethiopia going to the progress, in the direction of progress, with the new railway station, with the brass band, again, the idea of progress. But the brass band, the Armenian brass band, played a song called Pouet Pouet. And Pouet Pouet refers to the sound made by the, you know, the warning, the klaxon, in the car, when a man driving his car and a woman driving her car are having an affair together and are warning with this, you know. Man, I don't have to explain this. My English is very bad, but I think you understood the idea. So it was for an archbishop, for a Coptic archbishop, so of course it was not the right song to play to him. And there is another story which was told to me by Mr. Avedis Terzian, saying that in 1927 there was the visit of an Italian emissary, the Duke of Abruzzi. And he came to Ethiopia to make a declaration about the friendship of Italy towards Ethiopia. And there was a military parade in front of him, in front of the Italian delegation, but it was the military parade of the Ethiopian army, so it lasted very long, because the Ethiopian army was very numerous. So for hours and hours, the fanfare of the young Armenians were playing. They were playing, but after a while, they didn't know what to play. So they played the March Funèbre, the funeral march of Chopin, Frédéric Chopin. And then, accordingly, the Italian envoy would have laughed and said, "What is this?" And the answer would have been, "These are the Armenian boys, you know, they are really inexperienced, they don't know what to play, they finished their repertoire and now they are playing this." That's all. It is a funny story, and there are a lot of funny stories like this. One day I wrote a kind of manuscript. It was before my PhD. I wrote this story in a manuscript, and I sent it to Mr. Jean Dorès. He was a French historian that had studied for a long time Ethiopian history. He had published many books. He was retired in a small village in the south of France, and he was very, very old. But very kindly, he read my manuscript, and we had a correspondence. He was not writing emails, of course, he was writing real letters. And one day, he told me, you know, the story of the Marche Funèbre de Chopin is very funny, but I don't think it is only funny, because, of course, in Ethiopia, there is something very well rooted in the political culture of the country. It is the art of the phrases with double meanings, what they call the seminar work, if I'm not mistaken. It means exactly gold, wax and gold. There is the first meaning, which is wax, but when the wax disappears, under the wax, there is the gold. This is the true meaning of the sentence. And for example, in the musicians, what they call the troubadours, the Asmari, they improvise words when they are playing for people, and when they are waiting for the money of these people, they improvise words, good words, and generally they are flat. They are trying to say beautiful thing on the people, but in the meantime there is a double sense, which is ridiculizing the people. But the people laugh and they accept it because it is funny. And even at the court, the Asmari were allowed to mock the sovereign, provided that it was funny. It was well done. And so, he told me, Mr. Jean de Rest told me, suggested me that we could interpret this anecdote of the Italian envoy and the Marche Funèbre de Chopin as a true political message. I think it was a very interesting idea, even if I cannot, of course, prove it. And because at the time, although the Italian envoy was trying to claim the friendship of Italia towards Ethiopia, the Ethiopian government was not stupid. He knew that Mussolini was already preparing the invasion of Ethiopia, because 30 years earlier, in 1896, Italians had tried to occupy Ethiopia, but they had been severely defeated in the Battle of Adwa by King Menelik in 1896, and it was a kind of traumatism in Italy. And Mussolini, his propaganda was trying to say, we are going to expand, to create an empire, and the first thing we will try to do is to defeat Ethiopia, to take revenge of Adwa. Adwa was a real traumatism. So they were preparing the invasion of Ethiopia, and the Ethiopians were saying with the Marche Funèbre de Chopin, okay, we know you are coming, but we are waiting for you. And Mr. Jean de Rest suggested me another, gave me another idea. He told me that in the 1950s, during the visit of a Japanese crown prince to Ethiopia, the Ethiopian brassman, it was not Armenian, it was Ethiopian, played the tune of the bridge on the river Kwai, which is quite funny for a Japanese crown prince, of course. So, so that's why, from this proposition, hypothesis, I tried to evaluate if it was possible to find a political meaning in the creation of the fanfare of the Arbalijoj, the Armenian brass band of the king. And indeed, it was not the first time that kings were employing Armenian servants, and moreover, it was a period in which Ethiopian kings were trying to develop, to create a lot of national symbols. A period in which, a kind of period of invented traditions, if you take the concept of Eric Hobsbawm. It means that from the time of Menelik to the time of Rastafari Haile Selassie, Ethiopia was trying to assert its position as a sovereign country in a colonial world. So the kings had to protect Ethiopia of any invasion, of any submission to any foreign influence, and in the meantime to affirm that Ethiopia was standing on an equal foot with the European powers, and that Ethiopia was a civilized country. It means a westernized country at the time. In the ideology of Haile Selassie, for example, it is very clear. And so the music was part of it. But it was not the only, the creation of an official music was part of an official anthem was part of it, but it was not the only example. In the same period, they created the national flag, the money, which was created by an Armenian, by the way, Hakob Bardasarian, in the time of Menelik. They created also the first official portraits of the king and of the court, all the official portraits were made by Armenian photographers like Bezos Voyagian and his sons. I will elaborate on them later. And also the regalia, the objects of the kings, of the throne, like the crowns, for example, the golden crowns, were also made by Armenian craftsmen, jewelers, like Dikran Ebeyan. Here. So, it is very interesting because about this Dikran Ebeyan and the crown he made. He made the crown of Menelik, Emperor Menelik, so the imperial crown in 1889, and the imperial crown of his wife, Taitu, the Queen Taitu. And he also made the crown of Rasmakonnen, who was the father of Rastafari, the future Haile Selassie. And there is an anecdote of an Italian envoy in his diary in 1895, Count Augusto Salimbeni. He writes that I visited Menelik, and Menelik has two golden crowns. One has been given by the Italian government in testimony of friendship. Of course, it was a true friendship, because 1 year later they were at war. And the other one has been made by his Armenian jeweler, who is Tigran. But strangely enough, I don't understand why, the king, obviously, he shows that he doesn't want to put the Italian crown on his head, never. He always gives the preference to the Armenian crown, although the Italian crown is much more pretty and well made. Turn right. and it is not for an aesthetic purpose that Menelik didn't want to put the Italian crown on his head. There is a political meaning in this refusal. Of course, he couldn't have put the Italian crown on his head without suggesting that, admitting that Italia was a protector of Ethiopia, which was exactly what the Italians wanted at the time. It is exactly the reason why they declared war 1 year later to the Ethiopia, because in the treaty they had signed before, it was written that Ethiopia had become a kind of protectorate of Italia, and of course they denounced the treaty, and it was the reason for the war, the first Italo-Ethiopian war. So there was an Ethiopian, there was a political reason for this, and he could put the crown of Dikran on his head without any problem, because Dikran was not a citizen or representative of a foreign power, although he was a foreigner. He was not the representative of a colonial power, so it made no difficulty for him. And in the following years, for example, it is the same for the photographers. The photographers who were allowed to photograph, to make portraits of Menelik, were only Armenians. Only in the family of Bedros Boyajian, who was appointed official photographer of the Ethiopian court in 1906. And when he died I don't remember the date exactly, I think it's around 1920, his son took the charge of official photographer of the court. He was Haygaz Boyajian, and when Haygaz Boyajian died after the Italian occupation in 1941, his younger son, Torkom, nicknamed Tony Boyajian, became the national Ethiopian photographer, and he remained the official photographer until the Ethiopian Revolution. Even the first portrait of the first general who ruled Ethiopia, General Tafari Benti, in 1974, before the coup of Mengistu Haile Mariam, his first official portrait was also made by Tony Boyajian, which is quite interesting. So there is a first political meaning which is plausible in the choice of Armenian servants by the Ethiopian monarchy at the beginning of the 20th century. In the meantime, we have also to consider the religious link between the Ethiopian monarchy and the Armenian church, since they had a very close relationship in Jerusalem for centuries. And since I'm trying to make it very short, there were monks, Ethiopian monks visited Armenia in the past, like St. Eustathios in the 14th century. He died in Armenia. And on the way back, there were Armenian monks or clergymen, for example, Bishop of Anesutuji in 1679. He went to Ethiopia with a bone, bringing a bone of the hand of Eustathios, who had died 300 years earlier in Armenia. And it is very interesting that the bone, the relic, was accepted by the Ethiopian church. It is written in the official chronicle of Emperor Johannes I, at a time when foreigners were forbidden to go to Ethiopia, because after 1632, and for about 150 years, Ethiopia had decided to sever its links with European powers because they were fearing Catholic proselytism. They had bad experience with the Jesuits. And they expelled them, and the Jesuits who tried to come back to Ethiopia during this 17th and 18th century, when they were discovered, they were killed. They were killed. Some of them even went to Ethiopia disguised as Armenian merchants, because at the time, Armenian, be they merchants, lay or clerics, were allowed to continue to travel to Ethiopia. And that's why in a period when we do have not that much information about Ethiopia, we have a few written testimonies by Armenian travelers, which is very interesting. Because, of course, there was a close proximity between the Ethiopian church and the Armenian church from the time of the Council of Chalcedony, and also because in Jerusalem, the Armenian church was a protector of the Ethiopian monastic community. Even the patriarchate was giving its daily food to the Ethiopian monks in the 18th and 19th century. And there are many stories that I could bring to elaborate on this issue. So, when the first Armenian immigrants came to Ethiopia, long after the visit of Bishop Hovhannes Tutunji, long after the travels of Hoxha Murat, who was an ambassador for the Ethiopian kings in the 17th century, for more than 50 years, he traveled as far as Indonesia and Batavia and India several times. And far after this period, Armenians, the first immigrants, started to come to Ethiopia at the very end of the 19th century, with the Egyptian army in the 1870s, and later on with the after the Hamidian massacres, when the first families came to emigrate to Ethiopia, most of them from Arakdir. And at this time, the Ethiopian kings were using Armenian servants, cookers, gardeners, photographers, goldsmiths, gunsmiths, silversmiths, tailors, even women, Armenian women were working at the court, at the imperial court, and they had a very determining role, since they were working in the domesticity, in the inner life of the king and the queen, and so they were able to bring new uses to the court, sewing, for example, night dresses, which was completely new at the court. There are anecdotes on this, cooking new dishes, and introducing new uses at the court. So, in the 1920s, 1930s, there are even dynasties of Armenian servants to the imperial court that emerged. People who had worked for Menelik, and 20 years later, their sons, their daughters are working for Haile Selassie. For example, the family of Agop Bardasarian, the goldsmiths, for example, the Boyajans. I have quoted them, and a number of other families. So that's why, in a way, I think we can say that there was a kind of symbolic nationalization of Armenians in Ethiopia at this time. For families, thanks to the direct relationship of certain families with the Ethiopian crown, some of them who integrated fully the Ethiopian aristocracy, like this one, the Borossian family, Grigorios Borossian was a man from Bardizak, a simple craftsman. He married to an Ethiopian woman. He became one of the official furnishers of the palace in the time of Menelik, and his children occupied a high-ranking position in the imperial court. High-ranking, not very high-ranking, not ministers, but positions that were never given to foreigners. This is very significant. The positions occupied by Armenian servants were never the position of a governor or an official counselor. They were remaining in the shadow of the power, but they were acting in positions which would have not been trusted to foreigners. Only Armenians could occupy this kind of position. And these families, some of them, a lot of them, had close relationship, family relationship with the Ethiopian, within the Ethiopian aristocracy. And for example, the sons of Grigorios Borossian had the Jazmach Balcha as a godfather, and they are photographed with the portrait of their godfather. The Jazmach Balcha was one of the most powerful Ethiopian chiefs of the time of Menelik. He was a military man. So, there was what I called a kind of symbolic nationalization of Armenian servants in Ethiopia in a time when, for the Ethiopian kings, probably it was useful to have these Armenians. So, in a way, there is the idea of a long durée of the utilization of Armenians in Ethiopia. In the meantime, I'm not conceiving long durée as Fernand Braudel, something which kept the men prisoners of their time, prisoners of a tradition, or something that you cannot explain across the centuries. But I think that there was a kind of reservoir of representations from the 16th, 17th, 18th century that the Ethiopian church and the Ethiopian monarchy were still able to mobilize at the time of the immigration of the Armenian people in the late 19th century and early 20th century, that is to say, in the colonial period. So they were using the fact that Armenians for a long time were close to the Ethiopian church and the like, but they were using it because it was necessary to use this input in a colonial period, in a specific context created by the colonial time. Of course, it is very difficult to ascertain such kind of hypothesis, because all what I'm doing here is to elaborate on hypothesis. So, because the sources are very tenuous, very small. So, one of my best way to confirm or to try to validate, to evaluate the authenticity, the plausibility of this hypothesis was to investigate new kinds of sources, and mainly the oral sources, and to consider the memories of Armenian immigration to Ethiopia. And in these memories of Armenian immigration to Ethiopia, there are a lot of traces of such an Ethiopian policy, specific policy towards the Armenian immigrants. And that I introduced you to Mr. Avedis Terzian a few minutes earlier. And a lot of things that I'm able to say today, are directly related to the work I made with him for months. I had extensive interviews with him, and he was a kind of living archive. He was considered within the community as a kind of living archive of the community. Of course, it raises a lot of questions, methodological questions, but I have no time to elaborate on them today. But let's say that in the accounts of Mr. Avedis Terzian, who was a highly knowledgeable man, there were the main figures which were emerging were the figures of the founding fathers. Among them, Boros Hayrik Markaryan, Dikrane Beyan, and his own father, Sarkis Terzian, nicknamed Tullik in Amharinia, the Great. The Great because Sarkis had been one of the main smugglers in firearms in the time of the first Italo-Ethiopian War, at the time that there was an embargo against Ethiopia on the purchase of firearms. And because also, according to Armenian sources, and only to Armenian sources, he was the one who helped Menelik to seize, to occupy the Muslim city of Arar in 1886. So there are Armenian stories about this. Of course, you cannot check them, but it is very significant that they exist. And this is a photo which was taken at the time and was published in a French journal 10 years later. And it was taken. It is not a photo in a studio. He really integrated the Ethiopian army, the army of Menelik, after the capture of Harar. And he really fought in the Ethiopian army, especially in the region of the Somali area of the Ogaden, against the Somalis, during 3 years, between 1887 and 1890. He is also renowned as the one who introduced a lot of new technologies in Ethiopia, and this machine, the first steam roller in Ethiopia, which became legendary in the Armenian community, not only in the Armenian community, in Ethiopia at large. It was called Babur, because Babur is the word used for all the engine which worked with steam, and so it was. At the time, there was no railroad, no railway, no road in Ethiopia. So there is a confusion. We don't know exactly which was the purpose of this machine. Was it a kind of locomotive, or was it what they call a locomobile, something which was used to dam the roads, to make the roads? The Armenians claim that thanks to this machine, and all these people on the around the machine are Armenians, they are the close friends of the colleagues, the employees of Sarkis. Thanks to this machine, thanks to Sarkis Babur, many roads were, the first roads were dammed in Ethiopia, and that these roads were called Yosarkis Menge, the roads of Sarkis. But in European testimonies of the same time, it is said that it was a trick of the Armenians. Actually, the machine never worked. They tried to sell something to Menelik, which was not a good machine, and that the machine broke out. And it is true that we don't know if the machine really was used for years, or if it broke out immediately, we don't know. But for sure it broke out. At a certain point it broke out, and there is an area where the machine stood for years. And this area was called Sabara Babur, in Addis Ababa for a long time. So sometimes even the, of course, the toponyms, the names of the place, kept parcels of this strange memory, which is unknown in the books and in the archives. So, I don't want to be too long. I will try to also quote a certain anecdote. Oh, yeah. Of course, all of this, in a way, what I'm telling, 190% of what I'm telling is not possible to check. So, the difficulty is but I think it is not a problem. What is very interesting is the fact that people really believe in this account. And for example, for Mr. Avedis Terzian, the son of Sarkis the Great, Sarkis the Lik, he kept religiously this photograph that he gave me. And on this photograph, you see Menelik. This photograph has never been published before. You see King Menelik on the day of the founding of the Basilica St. George in Addis Ababa in 1903, Menelik, and under the umbrella of ceremony, you see Abuna Mateus, the chief of the Ethiopian church. And just behind them, the man here with the hat and the moustache is Sarkis Terzian. So for Avedis Terzian, this document was an evidence, obviously an evidence of Sarkis' proximity with the king. And we have the same kind of evidences for the Armenians with this photography, which was kept in the Borossian family for the founding of Menelik's hospital in 1908 in Addis Ababa. And at the time, you can see that Menelik was already an old and sick man. And on the photo, there is Krikoios Borossian, and it looks like as if Menelik was directing his eyes towards Krikoios Borossian. This kind of photograph that I was able to find in scattered in Armenian families, of course, are very valuable documents, but not only for the information, for the factual information that they provide, but also for the imagination that they authorize, for their power of interpretation that they have. So, this is very interesting too. It is a document which was kept by Avedis Terzian. It is a copy of an Amharic document. It is the passport of of Sarkis Terzian, a passport made by Menelik the king. Menelik says roughly that I am Menelik, chosen by God, emperor of Ethiopia. And Sarkis Terzian, coming from Armenia, born in Arakkir, age 39, middle height, curly hair, small face with a scar on the heel, on the cheek. And this scar, according to Avedis, it is fascinating because Avedis had told me that during his military service in the Ethiopian army against the Somalis, even my father had been wounded. And at the time, the war with where the Ethiopians had rifles and the Somalis had spears, you see. And when I asked Berhanu Abebe, an Ethiopian historian who died now, to translate this document, he told me that the word used for the scars indicated that this scar was coming not from a disease, which would have been something shameful, but from a contundent instrument, from a weapon, something very... Yeah. So, and he says, he served me for a long time as a civil servant, and now he is considered as an Abyssinian. I gave him this passport, this is a passport, in order to allow him to travel freely everywhere that he would like to go, because at the time Sarkis was traveling for the account of Menelik. He was making purchases, for example, in Europe for him, not only firearms, also machines, and a lot of things. So, this is very interesting for the text. There are odd things in the text which are very interesting, and in the meantime, there is something very striking, striking detail. It is the signature, accordingly, the signature of Menelik on the back, on the bottom of the document. Menelik officially never signed a document, and you will not find an Ethiopian historian or a specialist in Ethiopian history that saying that the king was signing his document. The king was only putting the official seal on the document. So, for Avedis Terzian, this was a proof, an evidence that Sarkis was the best servant, the best, the most loyal servant, of the preferred servant of Menelik, because Menelik had generously put his hand on the document, his personal hand, and had signed it. And even Berhanu Abebe, to whom I showed the document for the translation, he told me, it is not the signature of Menelik. It is impossible because the king was not even allowed to sign, because there was something considered as even nearly almost magic in the fact of writing. And the kings, although they knew how to write, they were ordered diakon before becoming king, they were not authorized to write in their public life. Only the seal. But I found this document in a book, in a German book, which says that there is here, there is the same period. There is a signature of Menelik. If you compare the two signatures, it is more or less the same. It is the signature of Menelik. And I found a third book, same time, saying this is the signature autograph of Menelik. These books, strangely enough, have been forgotten by the Ethiopian historiography. They say that Menelik never signed documents, but this signature exists. Of course, I cannot swear that there are the true signature of Menelik. Perhaps there are three wrong signatures of Menelik. Or perhaps there is a true signature of Menelik three times. Which is interesting for me is not to see if it is the true signature or not. What's interesting is that for Avedis Terzian, the power of the signature, the detail on the document, was powerful enough to be an evidence, the ultimate evidence of the reality of the fact that his father was the preferred servant of the king. And on this story, he he elaborated a global account, a global narrative, a grand narrative of Armenian immigration to Ethiopia, in which Ethiopians had preferred Armenian servants like Sarkis, like Boros Heydrich, like Dikla Nebeyan, and for these reasons, since Ethiopian kings gave their friendship to the Armenians, were the protectors of the Armenians, for this reason, Armenians became the closest people to the Ethiopian people in Ethiopia. And this was really something very strong in his narrative. And there is, I will end this chapter. Tell me how many minutes are left, and some, if I have to cut now, I can easily shorten.
You can go on for another 5-10 minutes. Hopefully, we have the room officially until 8. I don't think there is a class at this time, and I'm hoping that they won't come and remind us that we have 3 minutes, because I'd like everyone to have a chance to ask questions. So, let's take a chance. Can you sum it up in 5-10 minutes?
No problem.
We have enough time for questions. I'm sure people are dying to ask questions.
There are a lot of stories, and unfortunately I cannot tell you, but what is very interesting in these narratives is that these stories are sometimes very often unbelievable and meaningful in the same time. They are unbelievable, uncheckable, and very, very significant, very meaningful on the proximity between Ethiopians and Armenians. There is, for example, the I told it yesterday, so I won't repeat it today because some people were here yesterday. So, there is, for example, this I told it yesterday, I have to repeat it. There is a story of the coffin of Menelik. When Menelik died, his death was kept secret. It was a state secret, as in many countries, even today. You don't publicly proclaim the death of the sovereign because it can provoke a political crisis. And immediately. And at the time, there were rumors about the death of Menelik because Menelik was sick. He had several strokes in his in the end of his life, and he was not appearing publicly for years. So people were thinking he was dead. And one day, there is an Armenian tale saying that one day people from the palace came to knock at the door of Krikorios Borossian. I show him this picture. And they said, we need a coffin. At all costs, we need a coffin immediately. But they didn't say to for whom was the coffin. But Krikorios was serving Menelik. He knew that the boss was ill. So he immediately understood that it was a secret, that his patron was dead, and that he needed the coffin. So he went to an Armenian carpenter, whose name was Mateos Karamanian, accordingly. He lived, but of course we have no evidence of the fact that he really made the coffin, but they say that they made the coffin and that Menelik was hidden, his body was hidden, thanks to the collaboration of Armenian servants of the court. This story is only told by Armenian families, but several Armenian families, including the family, of course, of Krikorios Borossian. There is another very interesting story. It is the story of the coup d'état that was made in 1916 against the successor of Menelik, his grandson Ligiasu. And there was a coup against him when a photo was published, a photograph where the king was, the new king was vested, was wearing Muslim clothes with a turban. And accordingly, and this, it is not only Armenians who say it, there are many sources about it, it was an Armenian photographer, Levon Yazadjian, who did the photo montage and who played with the pictures, with the photograph, in order to make Yasu appear as a Muslim. And this was a political provocation, and after the distribution of this photograph, the chief of the Ethiopian church, he delivered the Ethiopian chiefs of their oath of loyalty to the new king. So there was a coup, and the first beneficiary of the coup was Rastafari. Rastafari became later on Haile Selassie, and he always gave he always expressed his friendship showed his friendship to the family of Livonia the Giant, who occupied good positions in the Ethiopian government for several generations. Yeah, you know, the photographers of the time, they were really playing with the photos, including the Boyajians. They were master in the art of transforming the photos and trying to readapt the photos and the details on the photos according to the canons of the Ethiopian traditional symbols. Playing with the crosses, playing with the position of the body, adapting to the to the aesthetic laws of the local society. So, just I want to finish by 5 minutes saying that this is a very interesting photo where we see the community with the portrait of Menelik. At least 10 or 15 years after the death of the emperor, which was considered by them as their protector. Very interesting picture. And I just want to finish by saying that Armenians, or descendants of Armenian immigration, in the 1920s, 1930s, they were much more than merchants and craftsmen in Ethiopia, because they were mastering the local language, not only Amharinya, but orally and also written in the written form. They were able to work as civil servants in many Ethiopian administrations, which was not possible for most of the foreigners at the time because they were not mastering the language. I would have a lot of things to say. I will finish just adding one thing. For example, when the Italians invaded Ethiopia in 1936, they were fully aware of the specific position of the Armenian families in Ethiopia and the fact that they were between Faranj and Habasha, if I can say. So they tried. There were projects by the fascist Italian to use the Armenians as a kind of element to introduce fascism in Ethiopia. It didn't work, although certain Ethiopian Armenians accepted to collaborate with the Italian, but there were also some Armenians who refused categorically to collaborate, and even Armenians who engaged in the resistance, the Ethiopian resistance against Italian occupation. And there was a clandestine newspaper called Amda Berhan the Ethiopia, Pillar of Light of Ethiopia, which was created by three Ethiopians and three Armenians, including Hovhannes Semerjibashian, in 1937, and they distributed a few copies of it to the Ethiopian patriots in the countryside. And after the assassination attempt against the viceroy of Italia in 1937, all the Ethiopian aristocracy was jailed, was imprisoned and deported to Italia, to Calabria, in south of Italia. And after a while, they released most of them. They only kept 30 of them, of these Ethiopian dangerous chiefs. They called them in the archive, in the Italian archive, dangerous and irreducible Ethiopian chiefs that we cannot release. And on 30 Ethiopian, dangerous Ethiopian chiefs, out of 30, 10 were Armenians. And we have their personal files in the Italian archives, including the Kerajian family, the Kerajian Markayan family, the Bardasarian family, the Gavendian family. And so it shows you the fact that these people were not at all foreigners in Ethiopia. They fully integrated to the Ethiopian society. Of course, they are all kind of realities, trajectories. Some of them really became Ethiopian, some other, most often from generations who immigrated to Ethiopia later on, they accepted to collaborate with the Italian, as I said. So there is a diversity, but we have to take into consideration the fact that at the time it was possible for people to integrate the host society and really to feel at home in this host society. I have been very long and my English has been very broken, and I thank you for having accepted to endure it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This was really, I'm not saying this to give you false compliments, but one of the most interesting talks I've had personally here. So I'm very, very grateful. I knew that my community was important, but I had no idea that we were this important, so I really appreciate it. And the level of the discussion was also particularly scholarly and very high. So I'm very grateful, and I'm sure the rest of you are.
So we have enough time for questions. I'm assuming we're not going to get kicked out. And if we are, then we'll have to keep it short. But any...
One question. You said about the coronation, the fanfare played the Tashmak music for the Turkish ambassador. From what we have heard is, first they refused. They said, no, these people have killed our fathers, our parents, so we refuse. And then Haile Selassie had to convince them to play. Have you heard anything about that?
Yeah, there are two stories, and it is not the same coronation, because Rastafari was coronated two times. First time as Negus Teferi in 1928. At the time, the fanfare, Armenian brass band, was still playing. Second time, in 1930, he is coronated as emperor. The Armenian fanfare is not playing anymore, but the fanfare which is playing is the Ethiopian fanfare trained by an Armenian young guy, Garabet Akalmazian. So it is very interesting, because in 1928, there is this story. When there is the first coronation, when he becomes Negus, from Ras to Negus, the Turkish envoy is there also. And indeed, there is this story that the Armenian boys refused to play the Turkish national anthem. And even if the Negus insisted, even the Ethiopian chiefs, they said, no, they should not play, because they killed their fathers and mothers. So they are right, they should not play. And even the Armenian interpreters tried to push that. No, you should play, boys, you should play. But Abraham Karajan, the secretary, the Armenian secretary of the Negus, said, no, you should play, it's a shame. But they refused, and the Ethiopian chief said, they are right. And 2 years later, which is very interesting too, is that the band who plays the Tashnak Dagan tune is not the Armenian band. It is the Ethiopian band which was trained to play Armenian songs. So there are many stories like this.
So two questions. So one, I was told, which is why I'm asking, because I want to verify, that the Armenian merchants who paid or asked Haile Selassie, which, by the way, means Holy Trinity, just for an extra assistance, quite nice. They paid Haile Selassie to actually bring those kids there. Is that true, or did Haile Selassie do it on his own free will? In other words, it was his desire, or in fact, it was a tatum that was the first question.
Thank you.
The question is the alphabet, the similarities of the alphabet.
First question, and after the second question, please, because they are very different.
Yes.
So I thank you for the two questions, because it allows me to remind these important details, I think. About the fact that they went to Ethiopia, it was presented in the Ethiopian official sources like the goodwill of the king, who was very generous, very charitable as a Christian king. And so it was presented as a kind of adoption of the 40 orphans from Jerusalem, the 40 Armenian orphans from Jerusalem. It is written as such in the Ethiopian chronicle. It is interesting because in the memories, they remain as the 40 orphans who have been adopted by the Ethiopian king. But in reality, they were not adopted at all. There was a contract signed between the AGBU, actually signed by the Armenian Patriarch of Jerusalem, Yerich Etourian, on behalf of the AGBU, and the Ethiopian Crown Prince, Rastafari. And in this contract, there was everything. Everything was fixed, including the salary, the monthly salary of the children, the fact that they will have uniforms, the fact that they will be housed, but they should buy their food themselves with their salary, and the fact, very important detail, that they will be trained in the workshops of the palace to learn a skill and a trade in order to prepare to become adults. And because this was the main concern, of course, of the Armenian organizations like AGBU at the time, what will they become? And finally, we have reports in the AGBU archives showing that the king didn't respect his commitments, and that they were never trained in the workshops of the palace, for example, that they asked for to increase their salary, but it was refused. And finally, after 5 years, it was a short-term contract. It was a middle-term contract. 5 years. It was a contract. After 5 years, the band didn't exist anymore. One third of them left Ethiopia. The others integrated the Armenian community. They married to Armenian women, for most of them.
23 to 27, is that?
24 to 29.
29.
Oh, wow. And but it is very revealing that in the memory it lasted as an adoption, as if the short-term contract had become a long-term contract without never-ending contract in the collective memory. This is very revealing of how the memory reshapes history.
By exploring Tertumne, I think that Yerushalayim Archbishop of Turyanin Tertumne, or Haile Selassie the Raka Arneye Ajetsene from Haile Selassie Asnagat, well, obviously from your answer, it wasn't Haile Selassie's.
According to the sources we have, very few, but even including the AGBU archives, it is written that it is the will of the, it is the proposition of Rastafari himself to bring them to Ethiopia.
And so the other story that when they all, later, when they graduated, that he had given them each 5 acres of land and...
Oh yeah, they were given land in the center of Addis Ababa in order to allow them to build their own villa, and they all built the same kind of villa in the same area near Hotel Guillaume.
Okay.
And so it was known as the place of the orphans, about 25 villas, Kovkovi.
One of my uncles was a member of the band. We used to call him Macho Dai Dai, but his real name was something Malchassia.
Ovanes,
yes.
Patapan gives Hike Patapan in his book in 1930 gives the full list of all the names of the 40 boys. They were aged 12 to 18 year old when they came to Ethiopia.
Can you say something about Hike Patapan?
Hike Patapan was coming from Smyrna. He was a member of the Tashnak party, and he arrived, I think, around 1900 in Ethiopia. He was not in the first immigration, but not far. And he's the only one who wrote a book about them. In the book, as I was explaining yesterday, half of the book is about Ethiopia in general, including fauna, which kind of trees, which kind of climate, the dynasties in Ethiopia, etc. And the second half is about the Ethio-Armenian community, and even at the end there is a small dictionary, Amharic Armenian, at the end of the book. He published his book in Venedig in 1930 on the Mechitaris Press. And he was not a historian at all, so there is no methodology, of course, in the book. But in the meantime, the book is very interesting because he knew personally some grand figures of the first generation, like Boros Markarian or Dikla Nebeyan, and he explicitly writes in the book that I have spoken with him, and he told me this story and this story and this story. And when I was speaking with Avedis Terzian some 70 years later, I understood that some of the things he was saying to me were already written by Patapan, just he had read them, and he was saying again the same thing.
It's an extremely rare book to get a hold of. Even through ILL on WorldCat, it's very difficult to get a hold of it.
Did you find, as you studied AGBU archives, was there any correspondence about him? He was a controversial issue in 1919 when he tried to represent the Armenian Republic.
Yeah.
I wonder if there is, I've seen the correspondence defensive of him. Are there accusatory things about him in the AGBU archives? Do you know?
No, I've never seen accusations against him. He became just to explain, after the proclamation of the Armenian Republic, there was an Armenian merchant, Matik Keborkov, who was the wealthiest merchant, Armenian merchant in Ethiopia. He became the official representative of the Republic of Armenia, and Patapan was a kind of consul. He said, I am the consul. But I have never seen any archive about this. Yes, in the French archive it was mentioned, but even the role of Patapan was not mentioned, only the role of Matik Keborkov. Yes?
Are you going to address the question of the language and the alphabet? Because I don't read Armenian, and I barely can understand it, let alone speak it, but when you flash the piece of paper that had the writing, I thought, well, those kind of look similar, not exact, but I noticed just from the pattern.
Yes.
I'll add two things. When I picked up a poster, I went to Little Ethiopia and I picked up a large poster of all the alphabet.
Yeah.
And it seemed to me a very weak. In other words, it seems like they're higher at the service of Sabine against Palma, but then they have unnecessarily. In other words, they have unnecessary characters, which if you put Hairo, Yebuda, Kokovitanestaft, and Burr Simagalabur, or Makam Kamichene, they have unnecessary contributions of character to create sounds that could be created with the root letters themselves. So it seems to be the derivative alphabet of something that
It is not an alphabet. No. The Ethiopian writing is a syllabic system of writing.
Yes.
It has many more signs than an alphabet. Mm-hmm. It is about 240 signs, I don't remember. Mm-hmm. 28 times 7. Huh? Okay, thank you. And so every sign is a sound like me, mu, mi, ma, me, mo, fe, fu, fi, fa, etc. and the like. And of course, and the like. the fact is that the Armenians, a lot of Armenians are claiming that Veslov Mashtots had an influence on the Ethiopian alphabet, but we know that the Ethiopian syllabic derives directly from the South Arabian writing, which was used in the south of the Arabic Peninsula centuries before the life of Veslov Mashtots, and which we can find on stones curved with very big letters. They are exactly, or more or less exactly, the same than the Ethiopian current letters. And so, if there was a relation between the two writings, it is in the opposite sense. Why not? But there was only an article written on this by a Russian linguist in 1968, I think, David Olderoch, and nobody has pushed the hypothesis further since then.
And in any case, only two letters look the same. If you look really closely, one or two letters. It's a pigment of one's imagination to see.
The Ethiopian B is a vo in Armenian.
Yeah.
For example.
I'm saying
that. Ah, you can also
yeah.
play with the letters like this.
Relations.
Yeah.
So to say we take it further, is there anything that I hope to is there anything that, because of course Krikor went through Armenia burning down things, so Vestrov had to recreate something. As I said anecdotally, is there anything to show that the Armenians had an alphabet Armenians had an alphabet before? Before Vestrov's creating these characters?
I can speak as an Armenian historian, there is no evidence of any writing in the Armenian tradition using the Armenian language prior to Vestrov. There are stories about the Danielian, mysterious Danielian script and so on, but those are, I don't think, have anything to do with Ethiopia. In any case, the Armenian alphabet is 405, 404. The Ethiopian alphabet, or this syllabic system in Ethiopia, predates that by at least a century, if not more. So I think the question, one has to wonder the assumption of that you're making that we taught them something.
No, I know, I'm not.
A lot of people assume this, though.
Yes. It is important to fix it, since you may find on the internet hundreds of websites claiming that Veslov Mashtots created the Ethiopian alphabet. Mm-hmm. So it is important to underline that it is not true. Daniel.
Boris, thank you very much for your talk. I have a question that I'm going to try to grasp at something, so I apologize in advance if it's not sensible and understandable.
I have a sense that with your study and with others, the number of the amount of research that we have on Armenians leaving the Ottoman Empire between, let's say, the 1890s to like the 1920s, so Hamida Master genocide refugees, and so scholarships about the countries they go to and their immigrant experience and their identity issues and so on, seems to be increasing. And the scholarship seems to be covering lots of different places. France, we have a lot, the United States, Ethiopia, Lebanon, and so on. So my question is anthropological, sociological. I wonder if you feel that by comparing these things, can we recreate something of the maybe deep sociological or cultural structure of Armenians, perhaps around the early 20th century, by looking at what elements of what like cultural artifacts Armenians are tending to abandon around this time when they immigrate, and what cultural artifacts they're picking up. Does that make sense?
Actually, for me, yeah, it makes sense, but for, I'm not the right man to answer this question. And since I'm not really an Armenologist, I'm not really a specialist of the Armenian world, although by profession I have to be interested by it very more and more. But I mean, throughout my research, I would be very, really unable to answer this kind, to face this kind of interrogations, because the sources that I had at my disposal are not cannot respond to this kind of questions in detail. But other people in the room could maybe answer.
I have a question, if I may.
You may.
So, as a historian interested in comparative history and global history and so on, I couldn't help but to think of parallels or similarities between the Armenian-Ethiopian experience, the Ethio-Armenian community, and other Armenian diaspora communities, either contemporaneously or earlier, and diachronically or synchronically.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, for instance, the one thing that naturally occurs to me is the closest parallels that I can think of to the Ethio-Armenian community are two communities that I happen to be also a specialist in, and I wonder whether it's because I'm from Ethiopia that I'm interested in these communities. And these are Iranian Armenians and Indian Armenians. The Indo-Armenian community particularly strikes me as being remarkably alike to the Ethiopian Armenian community in the sense of integration, in the sense of being regarding the place as one's homeland, but at the same time being an outsider, having a foot in the door of politics, state power, and also being engaged in commerce, straddling the world of commerce and statecraft at the same time. So I wanted to hear your thoughts of any, do you see any parallels with other diasporas, or is this a diaspora apart?
No, I mean, I remember the first time we met, you were giving a talk in École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales about the Iranian Armenian, about Nojura, and you were explaining with slides, you were describing the form of Armenian churches, and you were showing that they were looking like, they were shaped on the pattern of Iranian architecture, Muslim architecture. And so immediately, I mean, it made sense at the time for me. I had just finished my PhD at the time, but for me, I mean, it was the same idea that people, of course, they adapt to the local, and that the identity of the ancestors is not eternal, and of course things are moving. So I wouldn't say that the Ethio-Armenian community is a single case, although I believe that it is one of the most interesting cases, but it is because I'm preaching from my chapel. But I've read a lot about diaspora, not only Armenian diasporas, and this faculty to adaptation, this shift of identities, and that's also why I told you I'm not a strong believer in identities, and I think the identity concept is too fixed to be used in social sciences and should not be that used in social sciences. So I think this case study of Ethiopian in Armenian in Ethiopia raised a lot of questions which are common to the diaspora experience at large. And I strongly believe in this, that the diaspora experience is exactly this experience of hybridity, and that we can find in other examples of diaspora in Asia, in Africa, and also in modern Europa, for example, or even in Fresno. Right.
And also, on a personal level, I remember growing up in Ethiopia. I'm sure other Ethiopian Armenians here will corroborate what I'm saying or disagree with me, that there was often the case, it was often the case that people used to refer to us as Ferenc. I mean, I remember very well, distinctly as a young kid, being called Ferenc all the time.
Yes.
And so that memory, if it's widespread enough, might actually make your case maybe a bit more in need of being flexible. And the other one, yeah, the other point I was going to make is, from an internal point of view, and as far as being a member of the Armenian community was concerned, we referred to Ethiopians as deratis, right? Anytime you have that kind of language, derati versus menk, you're indicating that you're not entirely an integrated component of that homeland.
Yes, it is
so
true. Yes,
I know, for instance, Jews in Argentina never refer to the locals as locals. They're locals themselves.
Yeah.
But Armenians tend to do this all the time. And I'm wondering whether you have
I would answer that it depends to whom they are speaking and where they are speaking and which context they are speaking. Also, there is a generation issue, because what you are saying about the Ferenc word, which was used for you or other young people, it depends on the generations.
Yeah.
I mean, when I say that they were not considered as Ferenc, they were not called Ferenc, I'm referring to the early 20th century and the first half of the 20th century, which I know the best. I know for the second half, it is things changed a lot, of course. Even the status of the Armenians evolved, because, for example, Addis Ababa, in 1930, there were only 100,000 people in Addis Ababa. 1,000 Armenian, 100,000 people in Addis Ababa. So, on 100 inhabitants of Addis Ababa, one was Armenian, two were Greeks, two were Indians, one was Arabic, Arabs, and the like. So, there was a significant presence, although it was small. It was visible. In your generation, things have changed a lot, considering the expansion of the town and its population. I don't remember the objection. So, yes, it has to be nuanced according to the context, but I remember discussions, conversations with young Ethio-Armenians who still live in Addis Ababa.
Okay.
And for me it was fascinating, because they were explaining me how they could change their discourse of who am I, depending on to whom they are speaking. Oh, I'm not an Ethiopian. Oh, I am an Ethiopian, of course. No, I'm an Armenian. No, I'm not, neither Ethiopian, neither Armenian. So it depends on the context, and it is they are able to do this because they master the language, they know the codes of every belonging situation. I think it is really a diaspora reality. It is the illustration of a diaspora reality. And I wanted to ask to add something, but I think I forgot what I wanted to say. Anyway.
One more question. So I was going to ask the same question, because when I was growing up, there was distinct. We're different. And another thing is mixed marriages. I know that earlier generation used to take men. There's always Armenian men marrying Ethiopian women. Very rarely, I think there's one case of an Armenian woman marrying Ethiopian man, and that was after the third. But always it was.
You know the person.
Yeah.
You know the person.
Lawrence, right?
Yes, Lawrence. So,
yeah.
You tracked throughout 100 years of Armenian history, because all the kids who were mismarried, they were like outsiders. They didn't feel Armenian within Armenian community, and they didn't feel Ethiopian within. They felt more Ethiopian than Armenian.
Possibly. But for example, take the first families like the Borossians or the Karajan Markarians. They were mixed. They were intermarried. They felt Ethiopians, of course, but they belonged to the Armenian community.
But there were not too many Armenians.
No, because also because there were there were issues. Of course, there was racism. Also, Also, you have to consider the fact that they came with their wives, their families, entirely after the Amidian massacres, which was not the case for the Greek who came as many of them bachelors, young bachelors at the time, and so the Greeks much more intermarried than the Armenian in the early 20th century. But of course, there were also issues of racism. And only a thing that I wanted to add on the Ethiopian passport that these people have now, it is written that their citizenship is Ethiopian, Zegenet Ethiopian, and that they have also a national appartenance, a kind of ethnic appartenance. Thus, they're like in the Soviet Union, you were a Soviet citizen and you had a nationhood. Yeah. They are Ethiopian and it is written Armen on their passport. And also they are not a strength, they are not submitted to the military service, and there are distinctions that are made by the Ethiopian government. Also,
when is this now? Or
although officially they are Ethiopians, although they consider themselves as Ethiopian, but they know that depending on the political situation, they are not always as Ethiopians as the others. So they are equal, but not as equal as. You say?
You are not.
No, we have citizenship, of course. I still have my Ethiopian passport.
No, it depends.
Passport? Yeah. I didn't.
No. Not all of them had an Ethiopian passport. There were Lebanese passports.
And I couldn't get one even if I wanted to.
There were a lot of different situations.
You didn't know the right people.
Well, you got your passport because you had to buy it. You had to pay a bride.
That's
from the gatekeeper all the way up to the... You had to pay a bribe. So they asked me for a bribe. I said, I don't have money. I'm a poor man.
In my case,
now I can get one.
The ambassador, the Ethiopian ambassador to France, was a family friend and kept on renewing our passports.
Yeah. So we traveled with a laissez-passer.
I used my passport once to go to Iran in 2005. Came in very handy.
You were stateless?
There were a lot.
Even though you were born in Ethiopia,
Actually, in the 1930s, if you read the archives of the community, the register of baptisms, most of the Armenians, they declare their children as Ethiopian subjects and themselves as Ethiopian subjects. But in reality, they didn't have the Ethiopian papers. And at the time, the Ethiopian system was not, the Ethiopian government was not making any problem to people who had no papers, no definite nationalities. This became a problem later on. Even it was useful for them to have no nationalities, to be stateless like you, during the Italian occupation, because the Italians wanted to expel some of them, but they were unable to expel them because they had no country to serve them, except Italy. So finally they didn't expel them. Unlike the Greeks that they expelled because they were Greek citizens.
But some of the Armenians were expelled to, or detained in Djibouti. I know for
instance, also in Eritrea.
Besnilian, my cousin, what's his name? Hayropsev's father.
Yeah.
Samuel Besnilian was exiled to Djibouti during the Italian occupation.
Yeah, also Araxi Yazidjian. Her daughter, Anna Yazidjian, for example. There was a group of 20 who were expelled to Djibouti for the time of the war. It's only in the 1960s that it became important for the Armenian community to get the Ethiopian passport, because at the time there was a policy of Ethiopianization of the civil jobs, of the jobs in the administration. So it was becoming more and more difficult to get this kind of jobs if you don't have the Ethiopian nationality. So they asked more and more to have the nationality. And there was a visit of the Catholicos Vasken in 1965 in Addis Ababa. And just after this visit, the Ethiopian Emperor Haile Selassie, he asked the administration to give more easily the Ethiopian passport to the Armenians. So at this time, the Armenian community, in majority, became Ethiopian.
What year was that?
65, after 65, yes. But it was not... sometimes it was not good to have the Ethiopian nationality also, because after the revolution, when everything was nationalized, when the Derg regime collapsed, the new government in 1991 started to allow to give back the properties to people, but not to Ethiopian citizens. So the Armenians, in this case, they are considered as fully Ethiopians by the government. They say, no, you are Ethiopians, we can't give you back the property. If they were Italians or Greeks or French citizens, they would have taken back their properties, not as Ethiopians.
I didn't know that.
So there are ambiguities and subtleties, both from the Armenian side and from the Ethiopian government side also.
So, questions?
Boris, I know you went back and wrote another book. When are you going to publish it? Because I want to read it.
How do you know?
I got my sources. Well, my cousins, Mary and her daughter.
Yeah, we work together.
Yeah.
We translate it together. The accounts. The accounts of Mr. Avedis Telsian.
Yes.
It's about 150 pages of interviews. His words.
Yes.
They are only fantastic stories.
Yes.
And I'm writing the notes, and I have to finish the introduction, but it is very short. I just have to explain what this kind of document can bring to an understanding of their history. I want to publish it in English because in Ethiopia, people are able to read English if they are educated people, and these accounts are not only about the Armenian community, it regards Ethiopian history at large. He was founder of science on the Ethiopian society, imperial society of the 19th and early 20th century, and I'm sure it will be fascinating for Ethiopian people to read this kind of accounts. So the advantage is that this time we are writing directly in English and there is no translation issue. But still it is not finished because I have several projects like you, and so it's difficult to finish one of them. But you all know this.
I don't know, I'm anxiously waiting.
And hopefully the first book will be out in English, hopefully in the near future.
Hopefully in the near future, hopefully in a university press in America, we'll work on it. I thank you very much for your attention and your very interesting questions too.
Before we close, I forgot to mention one thing. I wanted to thank all of you, of course, again, but I want to thank especially some people, my Ethiopian Armenian compatriots, for having driven here sometimes from as far away as San Diego. So, Bohos, thank
my
you for
pleasure.
Coming. And staying here with Gregory and Asped. Asped is a local. He lives in Pasadena. But
Derati.
Thank you. Derati.
Yeah,
Derati.
So, anyway, anytime you have a lecture, I want to come. Anytime you have a lecture, I want to come.
Thank you. The good point is that it is not every week that I will have a lecture.
Yeah.
A good point for you.
I have a question. My French is very bad, and I don't understand very much what I read. I'd like to know if you're going to translate the book that you portrayed here into English.
This I want to do, yes.
So that I can, in my turn, pass it on to my grandchildren.
That's what it is.
Where we came from.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we don't pass it down, it will disappear. For which my offer still stands. I will translate it in gratis, because it's a pleasure to read your book.
Thank you for this proposal. And of course, it is my commitment to translate it. I really hope it has to be translated. The majority of the Ethio-Armenian community reads mainly, preferably English. And also, not only for the Ethio-Armenian community, I mean, this history deserves to be known outside of the Armenian community, because it is a fantastic history. Your history is fantastic. It has to be known. It has to be, So, thank you again.
But on the question of archives, you mentioned there are no archives. I know that I spoke with Nalbandian a while ago, maybe 10 years ago, and he told me that the church archives are in his home, at his home.
I used the church archives. I didn't say there was no archive. I've said that you cannot come for this kind of topic and sit in a place of archive and say, bring me this file.
Okay.
Bring me the file of the Armenians. It doesn't exist. you have to pick up information in several archives,
so,
but very tiny information that you have to complete also by other kind of archives, like oral histories.
A question, doesn't Ethiopia have a national archive by now?
Or yes,
has it ever had a national archive? They have.
For a long time it was not accessible. During my research, for example, it was not accessible for political reasons.
Do you know if they contain any information on some of these individuals, like Semen Djibashian?
I am sure there are informations, but I've never studied them. I am sure there are information. Mm-hmm. I also never studied the German archives. I am sure there are informations. Mm-hmm. Regarding the German archives, I think we will find more or less the same thing than in the French archives or Italian archives. But they have their specificity also because during a short period, Armenians were under the protection of the German embassy, so...
I think Semer Djibashian was a double agent, right? For the Germans and I forget which other... But there was a question of him being a double agent.
Yeah, there are very funny stories with him, and he worked successively for the English, the British, for the Germans for a long time, and after also for the Americans. And meanwhile, he worked also for the Ethiopians, and finally he was assassinated on the order of Haile Selassie himself, although they were very close friends years earlier.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, because he didn't accept Haile Selassie as the official inheritance of the royalty.
Yes.
He said that
But during the war, during the Italian invasion in 1936, Haile Selassie left the country. He was in exile in Great Britain. And the patriots, the Ethiopian patriots, after 5 years later, they didn't accept his return because they said he left us, he abandoned us, he gave up the fight. So we don't accept his coming back. And it is really striking that, revealing that Hovhannes Semer Djibashian, he became so truly an Ethiopian patriot that he didn't accept the return of the king, of his former friend. And finally he was killed for this. Hmm. It is the life life and career of an Ethiopian patriot. The life of, and his death. He died as a true Ethiopian patriot. So he was deeply involved in the local politics, like others. He was not this kind of diaspora man, outsider, somewhere out, hors-sol, out of the country, out of the host society.
Amen.
The story
Hello.
That was related, by the way, it's my name again, boys. The story that was related to me by my late boss, Vatke Seren, who was also born in Addis Ababa in the 1930s, was that Hovhannes Semer Djibashian was honored by the emperor once the Allies kicked out the Italians after the occupation, and
yes.
Apparently he asked the question, what would you like, Hovhannes Semer Djibashian? And he said, we would like democracy. And apparently the emperor did not take very well to that request, and that's why the order came down to have him, I guess, assassinated and murdered.
Possibly.
Just the account that was
made. Yeah, interesting. My grand regret is that I've never talked with Boros, Mr. Yahyayan. I think I met him in my first trip in Ethiopia. He was in the plane on my way back. Vatkes.
Bless his soul, he just passed away a few weeks ago. Right?
I think we were in the same plane, but and we exchanged a few words, but I've never had a chance to work with him. And you know, research is like this. You are always lacking time and money. And of course you are alone to resolve the problem. And my research and the results of my research would have been very different if I had been able to spend more time in Ethiopia, to spend longer time in Ethiopia, and also to work in Los Angeles, also to work in Montreal, also to work in Sydney, where Adelaide, where a lot of Ethio-Armenians went after 1974. That's why when I'm coming here and I discuss with you, for me it's also the perspective of a continuation of the work. And I think the work is not finished. I'm also working on a documentary film now about the same history.
Oh yeah?
Yes, but it's the same problem, time and money. So we'll see if we succeed. One
Do you
more project.
Any Ethio-Armenians in Paris? or in...
Yes, I know a few of them. They are not numerous. For example,
printer.
The Kherbekian. Their grandfather had a fascinating history, Minas Kherbekian, Minas Betefrash. He was the
architect of the road builder. Is this the guy who pointed his stick at visions?
Exactly. And one day, an Ethiopian guy in Lyon, he told me, he was a young guy at the time, he was young, I don't know. He told me, do you know why the roads of Hovhannes, Minas, were doing this and sometimes this and continuing straight? And I said, no, of course. And he said, because these were the houses, he was avoiding the houses where he had a mistress.
There's also a quotation about Minas that the Ethiopians say. Italian matahede, English matahede, Minas kar. In other words, the Italians came and left, the English came and left, but Minas is still here.
Yeah.
About Darakhtar, you know Khatch Darakhtar in Paris?
Yeah.
His father was the biggest shoe factory.
Exactly.
Darmar.
Darmar. He's still there, Khatchik. Yeah. He went to the Nubar library to say hello. He's a very kind guy. Very kind man.
And also, just a quick note, anyone who's interested in reading more about the Ethiopian Armenians and can read Armenian, can easily access three, four years of the first Armenian newspaper in Ethiopia, the first monthly, called Punic, printed in Addis from 1959 to 1963 or 62. And a full edition of it exists at the National Library Archive website in Yerevan, which you can easily download.
Oh, and thank you very much.
Because my cousin has the whole series, the complete series, and I picked up a volume and opened it randomly. My father's name was there.
It's incroyable. Super. I didn't know it. But just to complete the information, and as we said yesterday, there was another journal published by the HUM inside the HUMian community in the 1930s, I think, early 1930s. It was called Nordzarik. Like Addis Ababa means Nordzarik in higher end. And it was only a few issues. There are two issues in the Nubar Library. Wow. I have scanned them, of course, I can send it to you.
Please. Yeah. My grandfather, maybe, in 1929, artistic. Yeah. The first privately owned commercial press in Ethiopia. I feel like I've never felt this identitarian in my life. I'm an anti-identitarian scholar, but when it comes to Ethiopia, it feels different.
You are revealing your true nature.
Yes, right. Yeah, well, what can I say?
From your experience, what do you think of if you are Armenian?
Oh, very kind people, very good people.
Very kind. Politically correct that opinion.
I mean, there is no. I don't have an opinion on the community. I have an opinion on several persons, as persons. I don't believe in identity anymore for a long time. So I cannot give an answer. I would not authorize myself to say the Etio Armenians are like this or like this. Their history shows that there are individuals, and in a specific context, these individuals were able, free, to adapt in the way they wish to the circumstances. So, because the Ethiopian political, cultural, social context allowed this. And this is fascinating for me.
But since you mentioned that, don't you think this is part of a much, much larger pattern of, in world history, of states, centralizing states like Ethiopia under Menelik or Haile Selassie, preferring to trust people who were complete outsiders because they had no roots in that society. They were plucked from their foreign place. They didn't have a state of their own, and they were dropped, and they owed everything in their lives to the wealth and their welfare to the emperor.
Yes, but look,
to whom they had dog-like devotion.
Yes, but look,
they could be completely trusted.
You could compare with certain societies described by anthropologists, even in Oceania. You could, for example, in New Caledonia, where the king of a certain clan was always a foreigner, someone coming from abroad. You could also compare with the Armenians in Egypt on another scale, where they were used, and they were very close to the Khedive.
Yeah.
But the specificity of the Etruscan community is that there is this religious link, proximity with the church, and this you cannot find anywhere. So it is something very specific.
Okay. Louis Kozer has an essay on The Outsider as the Serpent of Butter. Louis Kozer, the American anthropologist, sociologist, I think?
Yeah.
There's an essay called The Outsider as a Servant of Power, and it focuses on outsiders who are easily malleable and who do not pose any threat to the centralizing monarch.
Yeah.
And I think Armenians in some ways were like that.
Yeah. I would be pleased to have the reference of this book. Yeah, it's very interesting.
In fact, I read that when Haile Selassie visited London, he went to the Armenian church, which was actually built.
I think it is true, yes, I heard it also, yeah.
It is.
Sarkis Church. Yeah.
And that church looks very much like the Armenian church in Ethiopia, strangely.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. At least for me.
There's a Brit, I think, who wrote a book about the Grand Tour, and it's a compliment to all the Ethiopian Armenians. He goes around explaining how in Ethiopia he went here, and he met all these nationalities, and then he describes an Armenian taxi driver, and in all the kachakos which you've met about Radze,
Evelyn Wu.
Somerset, oh yeah,
Evelyn
I was going to say Somerset.
Evelyn Wu.
And then he goes up to the end, and Armenian merchants, and he was shocked at the typical Armenian quality that but the quote at the end, which was the most lovely at all, was he said, "And I realize now that as much as I travel the world, I will never be a man of the world. And I hope that if I'm ever born again, I will be born an Armenian, because only an Armenian knows what this is."
Yeah, this.
And I thought,
these pages are beautiful.
Great. I remember that. All right. Well, unless there are any more urgent questions, Boris, thank you so much. I thank you all for coming as well. And all of you, I think, have written down your email addresses. You will be receiving official flyers from my chair regarding upcoming events. There is a talk 2 weeks from now, given by another Ethio-Armenian, by an Ethio-Armenian from Montreal, Gabriela Gerayan, who is going to be speaking about the integration of the Aleppo Armenians, the refugees from Syria, into Montreal Francophone society. And she's also giving a talk as an anthropologist. She's a specialist in Ethiopian Jews and their experience in Israel and race and so on. She's also giving a talk on a talk entitled Black Matters. It's on the experience of Ethiopian Jewry in Israel. So you will be receiving flyers of those events, as well as a conference that I have organized in December on the 16th and 17th on the Mkhitaryan Congregation. So I hope to see some of you there, and thank you all once again for coming, and thank you both.
Thank you.
I want a photo with you. I send it to my sources.
You're a ranger. 4 or 5 events in 4 or 5 days. I wish I had someone do that for me. Coordinator, organizer. Good for you. Log out to this.
It's not so bad.
You have to wait because I'm
I don't know how to do it.